From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is The Why. I'm Annette John Hall. When you see there's been a shooting and the headline reads something like, 5 people injured but nobody died, you might assume that everything is okay. But when these survivors leave the hospital, that's when the real battle starts. From accessing services to just getting a wheelchair lift that works, it can take years for gunshot survivors to get their needs met. Today's show, Wounded and Waiting. Philadelphia Daily News reporter David Gamber-Korda and columnist Helen Ubinis sat down with me recently to talk about why gunshot survivors don't get the help they need.
David and I have been covering violence in the city and violence period for a very long time. What we found is that for many people, you know, the story ends after the shooting, right? And for these victims, their stories just begin when they get home and realize that they're trapped. And trapped, actually physically, literally trapped in their own homes, in their living rooms, in their kitchens that suddenly become their, you know, their new bedrooms. They can't go upstairs. But also in their own heads, you know, the depression that overcomes these individuals who don't think that there's a way out.
In their recent series, Helen and David wrote that 116,000 people in the U.S. are shot every year. And as of November 2018, over 1,200 people were shot in Philadelphia. Survivors cope with the challenges associated with their injuries for years, including Rodney Whitmore, who was shot in Philadelphia in 1995.
Rodney was shot in a neighborhood shooting. Essentially, there was a beef between, you know, different groups of guys, and he ends up being collateral in that.
I was 22 years old.
He survived miraculously, but he was left paralyzed from the waist down. So he spent quite a bit of time at McGee Rehabilitation Center.
And I was sent home with nothing. I was lost.
So he was left to kind of improvise as to how he got around. You know, he was given a cushion.
It's called a J protector. I got it from McGee.
Which he sat on.
And I was sliding up the steps in the bathroom.
Wait a minute. I'm not envisioning this, David. How did it work?
You know, I think he just would sit on the cushion and rely on his upper body strength to steady him as he would, you know, more or less slide up and down the steps. And I think the cushion was there to probably blunt some of the trauma, you know, from your knees and your legs hitting, you know, old wooden South Philly steps.
It's hard to believe that actually, you know, his health service people gave him this to use.
We didn't find it to be all that uncommon. You know, there were other people that we interviewed that had the same sort of system, if you want to call it that, to rely on. And that's how it was for him for a number of years until he found out about the State Office of Vocational Rehabilitation.
Somebody told me about the Carousel House. It's a recreation center in Fairmount Park for people with disabilities. And I met this gentleman. He was where he worked at the front desk. And he was telling me how to go about, you know, getting the services that I need, like far as the stair glider, the outdoor lift. He gave me that telephone number and an address to OVR.
So he applied for a grant that they, you know, would come in and use to remodel his bathroom to make it handicapped accessible and to install a wheelchair lift on the front of his house. And what he found out and what he had stressed us was for that grant to be approved, you know, he had to make it clear to the state office that he wanted it because he needed to get out of his house, because he wanted to work, because he wanted to go to school, because he wanted to have a life and be a productive person.
I was on a waiting list for a while. I say maybe like a year or two, they installed a wheelchair lift and a stair glider in my home, and they also redid my bathroom.
So Philadelphia has an adaptive modification program, but the waiting list is pretty long, huh?
Yeah. City Council, I think, did move to devote a lot of funding towards helping them clear that backlog. But as of a year or two ago, it was 3.5 years. A wait time that you could be looking at. And the state has an office of long-term living, to help people with disabilities who need this type of assistance. They were only able to give me sort of a rough figure that they serve, approximately 60,000 people, but they don't break it down by, how many gun violence survivors are we helping. And that was an issue that we found across the board in working on this story, with the exception of the University of the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. None of the trauma centers in Philadelphia could tell us how many gunshot paralysis cases that they treat. We found only one person. It's Dr. James Schuster.
And I'm the director of neurotrauma and the chief of the neurotrauma service at Penn Presbyterian Hospital.
And he maintained a database himself that kept track of the number of gunshot paralysis cases that Penn has treated over the last several years.
If you talk about gunshot wounds to the brain, I think last year, so 2018, we saw about 20 gunshot wounds to the brain. Now, again, those are only the people that make it to the hospital alive. And so in my experience, there's probably at least that many more that never make it to the hospital. And in terms of the spine, it's roughly about the same numbers.
So, Helen, historically, there had been a push to stop this sort of research on gunshot victims from happening.
Right. It goes back to the CDC. Basically, what happened is that the funding was cut. They basically cut – the Republicans cut the funding so that, we have no real idea as to these gunshot victims and what's happening with these gunshot victims and how many of these gunshot victims. Bottom line, it's become sort of a politicized issue. This is not politics to the people, however, who are home trying to figure out sort of how to get this help.
I go out to nursing homes, and I visit young guys that's in the nursing homes. They don't know nothing about the services because ain't nobody there to tell them.
And that's where we're at. We have politics on one side, and we have the people who are living this life day in and day out not knowing how to get this help.
Right. There's no outreach or anything to let people know, even while they're in the hospital, perhaps, that these sorts of services are available.
When you're in the hospital, right, they're saving their lives. And the ER doctors here, in Philadelphia and across the country are these are miracles. They are saving so many people's lives. And so then they go to rehab where they're told about certain things, certain resources, and that's great. But then once you leave rehab, then you're on your own, you're home. And really what has to happen is that you have to do the work to try to find these programs. And you have two reporters who were doing that pretty full time for a while, having difficulty finding these programs. And then once you find them, realizing that there are waiting lists, that there's a lack of funding, and there's an absolute lack of outreach and awareness. And that's the biggest issue.
And the fact of the matter is that a lot of these people don't have time to try to figure that out, right? You're trying to survive.
Of course.
So what that means is that what we found, what many people turn to is GoFundMe and campaigns like that where they need money now. They need assistance now.
I'm having little issues with my wheelchair lift right now. So since OVR closed my case, I pay out of pocket every time. It's $285 just to come out and look at it for the first hour.
Like a lot of people, you're turning to GoFundMe as healthcare.
What makes shooting victims so unique in terms of the care that they require?
What we found was a lot of them have complications that go beyond just, if we want to look at paralysis as an example, if you are paralyzed as a result of a trauma like a car accident or a fall, it's sort of limited to where you were actually injured. Whereas a gunshot wound creates a lot more trauma.
If a bullet passes through your spinal cord, no matter what I do, I'm not going to impact the recovery from that. And so, unfortunately, the prognosis for penetrating injuries, whether it's head injuries or spine injuries, is much worse than standard trauma.
Helen, what is the biggest need for people that you've interviewed?
Honestly, home modifications, so that, you know, when they get home, there is a way for them to live in your own home, to be able to go upstairs to go to the bathroom if you have to, you know, go upstairs and tuck your kids into bed, read them a story at night.
What's being done at the state legislative level to address this?
With Senator Casey, he and about 30 other U.S. senators last year had called for $50 million worth of funding, to sort of get the CDC back on track with studying gun violence and possible solutions to, you know, what we feel is an epidemic, but we don't call it an epidemic for some reason. That really bothered us throughout working on this project. You know, we've seen a sea change in how we think about and talk about opioid abuse, you know, where now that has been declared a national health emergency and an epidemic, you know, even by the Trump White House. But gun violence, we still, for some reason, view as this smaller, separate issue, you know, that only affects supposedly a much smaller population. And at this point, you know, it's everywhere you conceivably can go, you know, to school, to the movies, to church. It's not just an inner city issue, which is usually how I think it's framed politically, but I don't feel like we've seen a huge appetite. You know, Casey has tried to make some noise. You know, the funding request that he sought last year was not, you know, agreed to. You know, Pat Toomey, who is a Republican, has also spoken out repeatedly and tried to get a bill through the Senate and the House to expand background checks. But that also has not gone anywhere.
One of the most interesting things to me was a suggestion by Jamie Amo, who also was a Columbine survivor. And the fact of the matter is that there's thoughts and prayers, there's lots of talk, but we just don't have the political will or spine to make changes. And she suggested that rather than just keep waiting for policies and changes from the White House or whatever, that perhaps guns should be taxed. And so use some of that money towards helping individuals who are wounded, paralyzed, after they're shot. You know, if we're not actually going to do anything about it, if we don't care, and clearly our actions have showed that, if we don't care that kids, little kids, are being shot, that parishioners are being shot, that you can't go to a movie theater, that you can't go really anywhere in this country without the potential of being shot and killed, then the very least we can do is help people after they're shot and paralyzed and wounded and trying to build their life up again. Basically, if you're paid to help these individuals, then you should be working really hard to do the outreach, to reach these individuals. And that's what's lacking.
Helen and David, thank you for all of your reporting on this.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for having us.
And that's it for the show. The Why is produced by me and Shai Ben-Yaakov. Kelsey Hansen produced today's episode. Our engineers are Mike Villers, Diana Martinez, and Al Banks. Special thanks to Ish Quintero, who created our theme music. WHYY's news director is Eugene Son, and the assistant news director is Katie Colinari. Sandra Clark is vice president of news and civic dialogue. John Musoni is assistant vice president of news operations. Tweet us at Shai Ben-Yaakov or at Annette JH, and drop a comment wherever you download your podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll be back Monday.